You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across the United States, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and many cable systems nationwide by both the Free Speech TV Network and Cable Radio Network, CRN. And please welcome Progressive Voices Tune In. They're carrying a station which is officially launching today, carrying the Tom Hartman Program and The Big Picture. Welcome also to our newest TV affiliate, carrying The Big Picture, Orion TV in Lake Orion, Orion Township, Michigan. And our newest affiliate radio station, WTZ 88.3 FM in Summertown, Tennessee, airing this show. Check your local listings. So it's like that plus two new stations last week. We be growing. It's a fine thing it is. Okay, all that said, one of the things that's also growing is the federal debt. It's growing at a slower rate than it was last year, and that was a slower rate than it did the year before. And it's been growing at certainly a slower rate than it was during the explosive rates of growth during the George W. Bush administration. Although a lot of the, in fact, virtually all of the debt that is being added on this year and last year and the year before was the result of George W. Bush putting two wars and Medicare Part D and a giant tax cut for millionaires and billionaires on the national credit card without making any provisions to pay for them. You know, the Republicans are screaming and yelling, oh, if you are going to increase Medicare benefits by even $1, then you've got to cut a dollar out of food stamps. In other words, you have to pay for, you know, any decrease in expenditures, or any increase in expenditures, rather, has to be a decrease in taxes and vice versa. But Bush never did any of that. He just stuck it on the credit card. Now the bill's coming due. And the president today in his news conference did an absolutely brilliant job of framing this. And after I share a couple of these clips with you, I want to get into what are the possible ways that this could play out? Because we could be looking at the beginning of the great crash of 2013, or we could be looking at the end of the Republican Party, at least the Tea Party faction of it in 2013, or we could be looking at the president caving in at the last minute. And frankly, I don't know how this is going to play out. Because he is holding a tough line, and he's got his framing right on this, the picture on this. Clip number zero, Shano. Here is the president at his press conference this morning.
Raising the debt ceiling does not authorize us to spend more. All it does is say that America will pay its bills. And we are not a deadbeat nation.
We are not.
And the consequences of us not paying our bills, as I outlined in my opening statement, would be disastrous.
Yeah. We are not a deadbeat nation. The consequences would be disastrous. This is the thing. Last time this happened, the president hadn't gotten out ahead of it and said, raising the debt ceiling has got nothing to do with my ability to borrow or spend money, because the president has no ability to borrow or spend money. That ability is reserved to Congress, specifically to the House of Representatives, in Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. So it's Eric Cantor and John Boehner who borrow the money and who spend the money. The president just has the job of writing the checks, because the Treasury Department is the check-writing branch of government. Now, clearly, this is not just the problem of the Bush administration. George W. Bush added $5 trillion to the debt, pretty much doubled the national debt. Before that, his dad had added $2 trillion to the debt. Before that, Ronald Reagan added $3 trillion to the debt. Well, actually, he took an $800 billion debt and took it to a $3 trillion debt. More than tripled it. But the point is that this all came out of a 1976 strategy memo by Jude Wininsky, the two Santa Clauses theory, that said, when Democrats are in office, yell and scream about the debt and use it to force them to shoot Santa Claus. the Democratic Santa Claus, of course, being Social Security, Medicare, unemployment benefits, those kind, you know, giving money to people. And when Republicans are in office, run the debt up as hard as you can, as fast as you can, and do not blink when it comes to raising the debt ceiling. And there has never even been a debate about the debt ceiling when Republicans were, a serious debate, when Republicans were in the White House. Here, again, clip number one, President Obama pointing this out.
I want to be clear about this. The debt ceiling is not a question of authorizing more spending. Raising the debt ceiling does not authorize more spending. It simply allows the country to pay for spending that Congress has already committed to. These are bills that have already been racked up, and we need to pay them.
Yeah, that would be a good idea, to pay them. And we cannot afford another debt debate, as he says. This is, again, this is a phony, made-up thing. Congress authorized these bills. People went out, you know, Halliburton went out and spent billions of dollars of their own money in the expectation that the government would repay them for this sweetheart no-bid contracts that the Bush administration negotiated with them. Now Halliburton wants to get paid, and Congress is going to say, no, we're not going to pay them, and by the way, we're not going to pay teachers, and by the way, we're not going to pay cops, and by the way, we're not going to pay for the FAA, and we're not going to pay for, and the list goes on and on and on. Here he is. Clip number two.
So while I'm willing to compromise and find common ground over how to reduce our deficits, America cannot afford another debate with this Congress about whether or not they should pay the bills they've already racked up.
See, this is such brilliant framing. Instead of talking about the debt ceiling like he did 2 years ago, instead of, you know, and letting people draw their own conclusions about what the heck does that mean, he's explicitly saying it every time he's asked about it. Every question that was asked afterwards, he kept bringing it back to bills already racked up. Here in clip number three is Obama talking about what's going to happen if the debt ceiling is not raised. He goes through some of the list.
If congressional Republicans refuse to pay America's bills on time, Social Security checks and veterans benefits will be delayed. We might not be able to pay our troops or honor our contracts with small business owners, food inspectors, air traffic controllers, specialists who track down loose nuclear materials wouldn't get their paychecks. Investors around the world will ask if the United States of America is, in fact, a safe bet. Markets could go haywire. Interest rates would spike for anybody who borrows money. Every homeowner with a mortgage, every student with a college loan, every small business owner who wants to grow and hire.
And here with clip number four, the ultimate irony, as happened 2 years ago when the Republicans stalled the raising the debt ceiling, or at least took us to the possibility of it. Here's the president.
It would be a self-inflicted wound on the economy. It would slow down our growth, might tip us into recession, and ironically, would probably increase our deficit.
Which are all things that the Republicans would frankly love. I mean, this goes back to that meeting in the caucus room restaurant the night that President Obama was inaugurated the first time 4 years ago, next week. When they sat around these 14, 16 guys sat around the table with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich and said, okay, how do we make sure that the president goes down in flames, that he's a one-term president? Well, do everything you can to screw the economy. This economy is in bad shape. Let's make it worse, which they set out to do. They were not entirely successful. Maybe this time they will be. But he's ruled out the trillion-dollar coin. He's ruled out the 14th Amendment. He's basically saying, he hasn't said he's ruled out issuing script, but basically he has said, this is Congress's problem. Now, I'll lay out for you after the break, you know, with the possible scenarios for this. And Stanley McChrystal is going to be with us in a bit.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He's going to drop by at the bottom of the hour, the retired United States Army general who was the commander in Afghanistan. Stick around. Helping you with the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and Jeff in Chicago. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. question. You know, we're talking about the debt ceiling and all the debt we're in. My question has always been, since they wrote unlimited checks for these wars, I remember Bush saying something about that the revenue from oil in Iraq was going to help pay for that war.
Yes.
And I never got an answer to what happened with that.
It was nonsense. I mean, Bush lied us into the war, or the Bush administration. I don't think it was actually George Bush who said the war would pay for itself. I think it was Wolfowitz, or it was one of those guys who was in his administration. But, you know, that was one of the arguments that was made, once we get a hold of those oil fields. In fact, Dick Cheney famously talked a bit about it being 10% of the world's oil reserves. Do you have that easily handy, Cheney? No. Okay. This meme was out there, and the Bush administration was using it aggressively to say, don't worry, we don't have to make a provision for spending on this. So they put it on the national credit card. They put Afghanistan on the national credit card. They put Iraq on the national credit card. The two of them are costing us at least $2 trillion, and probably when all the veterans' expenses come in, you know, 20, 25, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years from now, we'll have discovered that they cost us $4 or $5 trillion. This is what happens when you put a war on the national credit card.
Just kind of lip service from the Bush administration.
Of course it was. Every Republican presidency, every Republican president, Bush before him and Reagan, ever since the Jude Winiski memo, every Republican president has borrowed like there was no tomorrow, has just borrowed like crazy and spent that money. And then as soon as a Democrat comes into office, like Bill Clinton, they start screaming about the debt and forcing Bill Clinton to cut welfare. And then Clinton kind of kicking them back, raised taxes. Not a single Republican in the House of Representatives voted for that tax increase, by the way. Not one. Newt Gingrich gave a speech on the floor in 1997, I think it was, saying that this was going to bring about a Great Depression within a year, this tax increase. Instead, what it brought was 2 years of balanced budgets and a surplus. But, this is totally a partisan issue. The Republicans have been playing out this strategy for some time, and it's been working up until now. Now the president is messaging in a way that doesn't make this work, which I think is a fine thing. The other thing is that, you know, here's how it's going to play out, in my opinion. The House of Representatives, all spending legislation has to originate in the House. House of Representatives is going to put together a bill that raises the debt ceiling and cuts Social Security, cuts Medicare, cuts the child care programs, cuts education, jacks up the price of student loans, gives some more gifts to big corporations, you know, the stuff that the Republicans always do. And then they'll send that to the Senate. And they'll say, okay, we did our job, we raised the debt ceiling. They'll send that bill to the Senate. The Senate will strip out everything except raising the debt ceiling and say, okay, this is our bill. They'll pass that. They'll send it back to the... Now, this is assuming that Harry Reid has reformed the filibuster. I mean, if the Republicans in the Senate filibuster it, then they're going to take the heat for crashing the country. But anyhow, it gets stripped down by the Democrats in the Senate. Harry Reid sends it back to the House for conference. The House then has to, you know, either achieve a compromise or settle for the Senate version. If the president is saying he won't take a compromise, they're going to have to take the Senate version. In other words, just raise the damn debt ceiling. And, you know, we're back where we started. It's like, you know, you've taken a couple of pawns and now you're right back where you started. So we'll see how this plays out. Justin in Perryton, Texas, you don't think this was Bush's fault?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. So how is it, you know, I've seen an analysis. I'm guessing if you have a strong opinion about this, you've seen the analysis too, that 100% of the current deficit can be explained by four simple things. Number one is you take the number of people who are right now drawing unemployment and food stamps who prior to 2000 were paying into the system by paying taxes because they had a job. In other words, the recession. That's about, you know, 20% of it. Number two, Medicare Part D, it's about 15 or 20% of it, because the government cannot negotiate for prescription drugs, according, you know, for this law that the Republicans pushed through, the $600 billion gift to the pharmaceutical industry. Number three, there was this massive tax cut for billionaires, which accounts for about $1 trillion of this thing. And then numbers four and five, Iraq and Afghanistan. All of these were put on the national credit card, and George W. Bush and the Republicans who passed this legislation did not even try to make provisions to pay for any of these. They said the next president is going to be stuck with this. Now the next president has to pay the bills. By law, he's you know, he writes the checks. Even though he didn't borrow the money, he didn't spend the money, he gets to write the checks. And now the Republicans are saying, no, we're going to prevent you from writing the checks for the bills that we already ran up. Now tell me how that's not the Republicans' fault.
I'm not saying that that part's not the Republicans' fault.
Well, if it wasn't for the deficit, there wouldn't be a debt ceiling to worry about.
If you look at yearly spending, what the Republicans were spending 8 years ago, or 4 years ago, was a fourth of what this administration has been spending a year. Just the spending yearly. That's all you got to look at.
Our federal government. Actually, I think you're looking at 8 year numbers, not 4 year numbers. If you want to go back before Iraq and Afghanistan and before Medicare Part D. Obama has not increased spending. Spending right now is at historic low levels. Government spending as a percentage of GDP right now, you know, stripping out inflation, because obviously with inflation, you can always say this president spent more than the president before him. Every president does because of inflation. If you're just looking at raw numbers, but only stupid people look at raw numbers. If you take the inflation out of this, the level of payment, the level of spending relative to our gross domestic product right now is where it was in 1952 when it crashed after World War II. And by the way, when Dwight Eisenhower became president of the United States.
Nothing to the American people.
I beg your pardon?
But all these entitlements and free Medicare, that cost nothing. That's just free and clear always.
I'm telling you, if we went back to full employment, if the legislation that Nancy Pelosi got passed by the House of Representatives and was filibustered in the Senate by Republicans like Mitch McConnell and therefore blocked, that legislation that said to companies that have shipped their factories overseas, sorry, you can no longer have a tax break for having your factories overseas, and if you bring those factories back and those jobs back, we will give you a tax break. If we were back to full employment, all of that stuff would go away.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The one and only very simple reason why food stamps and unemployment benefits and programs for kids in poverty have gone up is because of the Bush Great Recession. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on Dish Network and DirecTV by the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome back. General Stanley McChrystal is on the line with us, retired United States Army general, former commander of the International Security Assistance Force, and commander of United States Forces in Afghanistan. He has a new book out. It's called My Share of the Task. His website, McChrystalGroup.com/myshare. General, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I spoke with a couple of years ago. This is back 3, 4, maybe 5 years ago in New York City at a talk radio convention. I spoke with one of the generals who was operating out of Afghanistan. And briefly, I was on a panel and I was walking out through the hall and shook hands and asked one question. And I thought in retrospect it was you. Were you at that convention?
I was not, Tom.
Oh, okay. Well, the fellow I spoke with, I asked him what he thought, how Afghanistan was going to resolve itself. And he said, one thing I know for sure is that we can't kill our way out of Afghanistan. What are your thoughts on that comment?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. At the end of the day, Afghanistan is going to be decided in the minds of Afghans. To give a little history, the Soviet Union fought there from 1979 to 1989, and 1.2 million Afghans were killed out of a population of about 24 to 26 million. You don't, in this kind of war, it's not like conventional war, World War II, where you crush the enemy. What you do is you convince the people which side they're going to back. It's like an argument between two sides, and the people decide which is most convincing.
Well, and apropos of that, right after 9/11, when the Taliban, and this was in the Washington Post, the Taliban explicitly offered to arrest Osama bin Laden and turn him over to a third nation for trial. They wouldn't send him to the United States, but they would send him to a third nation for trial. George W. Bush said, no, thank you, and began bombing Afghanistan. Afghanistan at that point in time had a GDP of $2 billion a year. We spend that there in a week or so. Wouldn't it have been cheaper to take bin Laden and put him on trial someplace and give Afghanistan, you know, $50 billion, $100 billion? I mean, give them like 5 or 10 years worth of GDP and say, here, build yourself a country, have a good time.
I think it's always easier not to fight than it is to fight, and always less expensive. But I'm unfamiliar with that being a credible offer to give up UBL or to stop harboring al-Qaeda. I think there was a point there where we had to be guaranteed that, in fact, the mechanism, the leadership that had actually caused the 9/11 attacks to emanate from that team needed to be stopped. So I think that was there's a reasonable requirement to have protected America by bringing al-Qaeda to a point where they couldn't prosecute that kind of attack.
Yeah. Your book, the epilogue to your book, I thought was particularly poignant, and it begins with a quote from Samuel Taylor Coleridge from The Rime of the Ancient Mariner that says, he went like one that hath been stunned and is of sense forlorn. A sadder and a wiser man he rose the morrow morn. Is that you?
Well, to a degree it is, and it's just why I picked that last verse from Coleridge. You learn from everything you do in life. And when I decided to write my share of the task, I thought about how to put all the experiences I'd had into context, to include the end of my career when the president accepted my resignation. And at the end of the day, as you'll see by looking at the epilogue, the epilogue's about leadership, and that was my experience. You know, the things that happen to you, the little controversies, the people that you know, you may like or not like, they don't become very important when you really capture the history of your life. Really, the story I was trying to tell was a history story wrapped in leadership and trying to communicate some of the amazing service of people that I got to be alongside and some of the big ideas that I experienced over so many years. So the little things don't make so much difference, but you do learn from all of them. And I learned from that.
Well, apropos of that, when Rolling Stone ran the article in which some of your officers were quoted speaking derisively or negatively of the president that led to your resignation, in retrospect, do you think it would have been better to push back and say, no, that's not me?
You know, I thought a lot about that. In fact, there was an Inspector General report, Department of Defense, that came out some months later that took a very different view of the conclusions of the article than the article portrayed. But at the time, there were several things at work. First, we were in the process of a difficult part of the operation in Afghanistan, and that had to be most important. Second is President Obama is trying to lead a nation. He's a commander-in-chief, and one of the things one of his subordinate commanders, me, should try to do is prevent controversies from making his job more complicated. Now, whether I think that article was fair or not, it puts a controversy right in front of the president that he's got to deal with. So I thought it was my responsibility to offer my resignation and accept responsibility, whether I thought the article was particularly a fair depiction or not.
Yeah. Well, and apropos of that kind of, you know, it's reflecting poorly on the administration, or it's getting back to the administration, or it's turned into a tabloid story, General Petraeus, you know, found himself in a very, very different situation from you. But he and another general have apparently characterized the situation as being that there are general groupies out there. Are there groupies who follow generals around?
Well, I didn't have any, so I don't know.
Okay.
It's a great question.
Yeah. Well, so much for that one. I'm curious your thoughts about the elite kill squads that we've heard so much about.
Yeah. When we were, particularly the rise of this in Iraq, is we took the Task Force 714, and in my book what I do is I really lay out how the entire task force matured, and it became this incredibly effective force that did up to 300 raids a month, i.e. 10 a night, against a growing al-Qaeda in Iraq network. And led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, this network was extraordinarily bloodthirsty and extraordinarily lethal, killing Iraqi civilians by the thousands. So we had to build a network to defeat that, and it caused us to fight entirely different than we ever had before, really to be information-centric, to be an intelligence-based organization as opposed to other. Now, they weren't kill squads. What they were was we had teams that went out always with the effort to capture because we wanted to get information, but really to dismantle this network that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had created and was constantly growing, accelerated by some of the outside pressures as well.
As a military man, does it, and a long tradition in the military and your family as well, and I'm sure your knowledge of the history of the military in the United States, the founders being so wary of a standing army that they require reauthorization every 2 years, only for the army, not for anything else on earth. Does it concern you that a non-military branch of the executive branch, the CIA, is using drones to conduct extrajudicial killings in inside countries with whom we are not at war? Drone strikes.
The way I'll take that is I'd first say that the use of, we call them unmanned aerial vehicles like the Predator, are extraordinarily important. They provide information. They allow you to watch things you couldn't watch, and they do have a strike capability. I think they are a necessary part of the tools that the United States should have and use effectively. Now, at the same time, I would say we need to be very, very cognizant that for everything you do, there is a reaction to it.
Yep.
When you shoot anything, but now it's become focused on drones in a foreign country or even in a country where you are operating, it's how it's perceived by the people matters a lot. I used to describe to people in 1998 when President Clinton made the decision to launch Tomahawks into Sudan and parts of Afghanistan, in response to al-Qaeda's attacks on the embassies in East Africa, if you'd ask an American the next morning whether or not we were at war, most Americans would have said, no, we're not at war. We just shot some Tomahawks. If you asked someone in the vicinity of those Tomahawk strikes whether they were at war with the United States, they might have a different perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's important we understand that, because how people view us in the world determines how they act.
Well, and it's if Mexico decided that their narco problem was to send a drone over Phoenix and take out a house full of Mexican bad guys, I don't think Arizona would react very well, or America for that matter.
I think that's a good description. Whether or not their strike was against the correct target, we would probably be, unhappy with it.
Yeah, yeah. It seems that there's a lot of that going on in the world. Sir, we're pretty much out of time on this, but I just want to say I found this a fascinating book. We're talking with General Stanley McChrystal, U.S. Army retired. My Share of the Task, a memoir, is the title of this book. The website is McChrystal, M-C-C-H-R-Y, Crystal Group, McChrystalGroup.com/myshare. Thank you for writing this book, and thank you for being with us today.
Tom, thank you. Take care.
Good speaking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Aaron Schwartz, dead at 26. I want to share my thoughts about that with you after the break. Fair and only slightly unbalanced, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Henry in Osceola, Arkansas. Hey, Henry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Just great. Yeah. I'll get better.
Yeah. The thing on my mind, the caller that you had before the general, you explained it to him how the federal government now is actually spending less money. But the one thing I think kind of slipped your mind on that, when he talked about Barack Obama spent more money than the other presidents than Bush, they keep forgetting George Bush never put the war money on the books.
That's right.
So it didn't show up. 6 years, right. Obama had to put 6 years of war on the books. So he was already in a bigger hole for Joe Street than Bush was anyway.
Yeah.
But these people are consistently trying to change up the wording and trying to get you and these other shows to say, yeah, Barack spent more money when in actuality he hasn't.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and thanks for the point. And I mean, who knows? It might be one of those guys who's paid to sit in a room and dial phone, you know, dial into radio shows all day long. There was a thing on the internet the other day about how, you know, some guy coming out as I was a paid internet shill, and his job is to go hit blogs and message boards and comment lines on New York Times articles and things and post things that were favorable to his employer, which in his particular case was. One of the pro-Israel lobbies, but you know, the point he was making is that this has got nothing to do with Israel or the lobbies, and it wasn't limited to them. There were other people doing it for other big corporations, weapons manufacturers, for example. Tim in Lincoln Park, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
I'm surprised actually a person actually admitted that openly, but
yeah, he
I
did.
I wanted to go back to that's interesting. I wanted to go back to U.S. war policy. I remember reading Seymour Hersh years ago. This had been back in 06. And I think there were other commentators, too, and journalists. They had found that Dick Cheney had authorized JSOC teams to go into Iraq and effectively act as death squads. Now, the rationale by Cheney and others was that, well, they were killing so-called terrorists, but people like Hirsch found also that Iraqi civilians were killed.
Yeah.
And also, during the raid in Sudan, when Clinton ostensibly was trying to hunt down al-Qaeda because they were implicated in bombings in Tanzania, in Kenya, also a baby milk factory was bombed. So quite often U.S. war policy isn't really honestly explained, in my opinion, by our leadership.
Yeah, I don't disagree. One of the big turning points in my mind was, you know, John Negroponte, back when he worked in the, I believe it was the Reagan administration, was sent down to South America, or Central America, rather, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, that region. And suddenly the death squads showed up, and people, they found all these people with their hands tied behind their back and a bullet in the back of their head. And when he was sent off to Iraq on this program, I said, John Negroponte's going to Iraq. Pretty soon you're going to see news stories of people showing up with their hands tied behind their back and bullets in their heads. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, that's exactly what happened. It led the evening news for a week.
Popped up,
Yeah, it's you know, enough with the death squads already. That should not be the policy of the United States of America. Tim, thank you for the call. Leonard in Seattle. Hey, Leonard.
Hey, thank you very much. You know, I had a question to ask you, and I really had it on my mind. I know that I just heard today that basically we're going to run out of money by next month. And my question is to you is that if Congress fails to act on raising the debt ceiling and the economy is destroyed, will it be pretty much their fault? Because it sounds to me like, from what the president said this morning, is that if the debt ceiling is not raised, that means people like me, that means there will be no Social Security checks going out, no food stamp checks going out, nothing going out.
Yeah.
Basically, the economy will just ultimately be destroyed.
Right.
And that's why I'm asking.
Well, here's just, you know, for context, here's clip number three. Here's what the president had to say.
If congressional Republicans refuse to pay America's bills on time, Social Security checks and veterans benefits will be delayed. We might not be able to pay our troops or honor our contracts with small business owners, food inspectors, air traffic controllers, specialists who track down loose nuclear materials wouldn't get their paychecks. Investors around the world will ask if the United States of America is in fact a safe bet. Markets could go haywire. Interest rates would spike for anybody who borrows money. Every homeowner with a mortgage, every student with a college loan, every small business owner who wants to grow and hire.
So that's the consequence, Leonard. And the fact of the matter is only Congress, specifically the House of Representatives, has the power to raise taxes, to increase or decrease spending, and to establish or increase or do away with the debt ceiling. And so if this thing blows up, as long as the president holds fast, and this is the thing everybody's asking, is he going to cave in at the last minute or not? Because if the president holds fast and says this is Congress's responsibility, this is not something the White House is supposed to even be involved in, it's up to Congress to do this, they either do it or they don't, because they authorized this spending to begin with, and now all we do is write the checks. You know, the Treasury Department sends the checks out, and they're saying we can't send the checks out. Then yes, absolutely. It's the Republicans in Congress. It's their fault. And people should be getting that. Leonard, thank you for the call. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Tom, you there?
I am.
Hey, check this out. The general, he should be made aware that he represents the people.
Well, the general doesn't. The general has a job and he works for the president.
Say that again?
The general does not represent the people. Nobody in the military does. They have a job. They work for the executive branch. They work for the president. The president represents the people. He has to answer to the people. Generals don't have to answer to the people. They answer to the commander-in-chief.
And the commander-in-chief is who?
Is the president. And he, and as I said, he is answerable to the people. But I don't think that any general, you know, in history has or should be, actually, you know, paying attention to
by
to public opinion.
Public opinion.
Yeah.
Public opinion is a good opinion.
Well, sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. I mean, when we went into Afghanistan, the public opinion was, let's go in and kick the butts of the guys who hit us in 9/11. And I think it was stupid. I don't think that that was the best way to do it. I think if we'd gone in with a large amount of money rather than a large number of troops, we could have turned. I mean, this is a country where the average annual income was about $100 a year. It had an entire GDP of $2 billion a year, the entire nation. That's federal spending. That's measured in minutes. We could have gone into Afghanistan and said, okay, there's a reward of $1 million on the head of these 20 guys with Al-Qaeda. And I guarantee you those 20 guys would have been dragged out of that country kicking and screaming by Afghans. This is a war we did not need, but George W. Bush wanted to have a war.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And my connection just crashed. So is it possible that Danielle can put our guest on from there? Okay, we're resetting our system. Meanwhile, there's a revolt going on in Seattle. I thought this was really cool. You know how George W. Bush had this "let's test every child" thing? You know, dramatically increase school testing. His brother Neil, of course, had started a school testing company. Used to be the teachers would take the test out of the back of the book and maybe rewrite it in their own words, or maybe just take it verbatim and run it off on the copy machine, and they'd pass the test, you know, out to the kids, and kids would. You know, and the teacher would grade it at the end of the night. And that would help the teacher know which of the kids needed a little more work in what areas so they could individualize their instruction. And also it could lead to a grade. But when Neil Bush started this educational testing business down in Texas and took it national back in the early 2000s, the two aughts, George W. Bush got on the bandwagon and started mandating, you know, hundreds of these tests that instead of costing, you know, less than a penny a page, it started costing $10, $20, $30, $40 per test, because it's copyrighted material, after all, that were produced virtually exclusively by for-profit corporations. So now in Seattle, we have one school where the teachers have right across the board said, no, we are not going to administer these tests. And we're not going to teach to the test. We're going to teach our kids what they need to know, not how to pass a test. That is crazy. You know, just teaching them how to pass a test. It ain't the way we're going to go. So, which line is our guest on? 11 is not on my board. So, there we go. Thank you very much. Okay, speaking of that, moving along from that, here we have Nicole. Is it Jelinas, Nicole? Nicole?
Yes.
Is your last name pronounced Jelinas?
Jelinas.
Jelinas. Thank you very much. You're the Searle Freedom Trust Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor to City Journal. Manhattan-Institute.org is the website. We have Washington, D.C., recovering from the effect of an earthquake. They're still doing construction or repair work on the Washington Monument. We have Joplin, Missouri, still rebuilding from a tornado. We've got people up and down the East Coast who are recovering from Hurricane Sandy. And I understand that your position on all this is that any kind of federal insurance to these people is essentially welfare. Do I have this right?
No, I don't think I said it was welfare. I think I said it was another middle class entitlement, which is much broader than welfare and much more difficult to fix. You know, we fixed welfare because people think it's poor people. It's much harder to fix something that everybody feels like they're paying for, so they deserve. And that's what disaster aid to individuals has become. You know, there's no reason that taxpayers should underwrite flood insurance for someone who chooses to live in a place with water in the name, whether it's beach or shore or ocean and so forth. The risk of flooding should be reflected in the cost of the house. Instead, we have federally subsidized flood insurance. This distorts an important market signal. The market is saying it is risky to live in these areas. People should be able to hear that signal so they could decide what to do. And if there's anyone who should be upset about it, it should be, for example, environmentalists. You know, people lamenting for decades coastal building, particularly in places like Florida. You know, Florida has been built up on swampland because of government subsidized insurance, really for no other reason. It's a massive, massive liability. And, you know, there's a fairness issue here. You want to talk about welfare. You've got people who live in inland New York in smaller houses or apartments, don't live with the beach view and with the bigger house as you go further out, but they're paying insurance to subsidize people's rebuilding on the coast. Again, doesn't mean it's not sad if a person lost their home. Doesn't mean that you know, things aren't tough and there's you know, it's good to be sympathetic and empathetic. But where does the federal responsibility for this start and stop? There's been no question about that in the rhetoric surrounding the bills.
Many of the people, particularly we're talking, you're talking Hurricane Sandy here. Many of these people did not, you know, there hasn't been anything like Hurricane Sandy in 100 years. They had no idea that their house could be washed away.
No idea that your house is vulnerable to flood when you live in Midland Beach or Ocean Parkway or Gareton Bay or, you know, any place where, you know, Seagate, I went out there, the houses are right on the ocean. Not true in all of the cases, but the reason you had a flood is because it's near the water.
Well, relatively speaking, I mean, there was flooding, you know, 10 miles inland in places.
10 miles inland?
Yeah, there was.
Where did you see flooding 10 miles inland?
Well, there's flooding
Lower
all over
Manhattan. It's right on the water.
Okay, so your argument is that I'm curious how you think about Joplin, Missouri. Those people plan to build their houses in Tornado Alley. Should there be federal insurance against tornadoes?
Well, I think, you know, obviously inconsistencies come in the details, you know, and that's why I like to look at each case by case. I think there's a role for disaster aid. And by the way, there's plenty of role for disaster aid in Sandy. We didn't talk about that. It's just that helping people to build individual houses, which at $15 billion is the biggest component of this bill, not even including the other $10 billion for the flood insurance, that is not the best way to go about funding the disaster from Sandy. I think, you know, with
so what is the best way? People who bought a home in good faith, not thinking that someday my home might be wiped out. Yes, maybe Bay or Gulf or Beach or Long Island was in the name. But it, you know, as I said, in the lifetime of anybody in their neighborhood, these had never been flooded. And so we're just supposed to tell them, you know, take a hike.
No, I think, you know, going back to the point about Joplin, Missouri, I think if you're in a situation where the private insurance market has identified a systemic risk that it's almost certain that this is going to happen at some point during your ownership of the house, and therefore, you know, there's no insurance coverage for that. That's a real signal that this shouldn't be borne by everyone else, so that you're encouraging repetition of the same behavior. So if you really have a disaster that is a one-off disaster, it doesn't seem likely that it's going to happen again.
But increasingly, there's no one-off disasters. I mean, the global climate is getting getting more and more unstable, more and more unpredictable.
And
storms are becoming more and more violent.
We need the market to provide this signal. The market is not providing the signal if the federal government is stepping in and taking care of it. You know, there's a real issue here of finite resources.
Isn't there, though, a very real issue here of we are our brother's keeper? If our neighbors are devastated, don't we have... I mean, isn't that the essence of society, of civilization, that we help out people who impossibly could not help out themselves? They've lost everything?
I think it's a very good question, and I think it's hard to know the answer, and I think the line is somewhere between saying, okay, you lost everything you own, and the government isn't going to do a thing for you, and the other side of the line, which Governor Cuomo is pushing, which is, okay, you've lost everything you own, and the government's goal is...
Well, the middle ground, when we lived in Vermont, we had a river that took out several houses in a city near our home, and the city, you know, through the Fifth Amendment, took that land, paid the homeowners for the value of their homes that had literally washed down the river, and turn it into a public park. Said, okay, nobody's ever going to build on this land again. Isn't that a reasonable middle ground?
I think that's a better solution than encouraging people to keep rebuilding within a floodplain. And again, you know, I think if a person wants to live in a place called Seagate, and I'm not picking on them, you know, many, many neighborhoods in this condition, and you've got the nice house.
It just sounds to me, Nicole, like mostly what you're doing is you're making the argument for the Republicans obstructing this flood relief.
No, I'm not making that argument. I'm saying that the money should go toward public infrastructure, which is beef up the public transportation system to prevent it from flooding, beef up flood walls and flood protections in areas where...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, Nicole DeGolinas, Manhattan-Institute.org is the website. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. As I said, my apologies for my last debate. I did not do my homework. And the one thing I need to learn, and I don't have the statistics here, and I should have looked this up, is what this federal flood insurance covers. I don't know if it covers, you know, who the money goes to. I don't know how it works, and I need to learn that, and I need to do some homework on that. If you know, feel free to let me know, but... in the future, I will not go into a debate situation without having my information. Again, my apologies. My morning went crazy. Clint in Vail, Colorado. Hey, Clint.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm chiming in on the flood insurance thing, and I understand empathy and helping your neighbor and your brother's keeper. I understand that comment, but where does the responsibility begin and end, especially on a federal level? Because
I don't disagree that if you live in a floodplain and your house gets wiped out, that there's a very strong case to be made for not saying, okay, we're going to rebuild your house right here. I don't disagree with that. However, if you live on a floodplain or what is, you know, many of these people whose houses got wiped out in Sandy Hook were not on a floodplain. Sandy, you know, Hurricane Sandy was an exceptional storm. It was a superstorm. It was a consequence of this massive global warming. We got 5% more moisture in the atmosphere than we had when Reagan came into office. And so the consequence of that is people got wiped out who never in their wildest dreams thought they'd be wiped out. Now, if you don't want to rebuild on that spot, then at least cover the cost of moving them someplace else and saying, okay, we're not going to rebuild you on this house, on this spot. We're going to turn this spot into a public park and, you know, we'll figure out some property out in Wyoming that you can live on or whatever.
I guess that's my point. Yes, there's a level of responsibility and maybe a level of ignorance. Now, global warming, believe it, not believe it, whatever it is. Like I told your call screener, I live here in the mountains, and you bet I have flood insurance. I have taken every precaution knowing that, okay, the snow has changed, the rain has changed, sure, the hurricanes seem to be more. I see that trend, okay. Not to put too fine a point on it or debate causes and not causes. But I've upgraded all my policies knowing that and said, okay, well, I don't want, I call it the anti-weasel clause. I don't want the insurance company weaseling out of paying anything.
Sure.
But that's on me. Now, the people that chose not to pay that premium, or like you said, they never dreamed of this ever happening. Well, that's part of the problem. I never dreamed that Vail would get this little amount of snow. It's 22 below today, but there's only 3 feet of snow, which is nothing.
Yeah.
And that's just it. Where's the forward thinking of, okay, I should really insure myself for that event and be responsible. I just don't see putting it on the backs of everyone else to say, okay,
again, Clint, I can't intelligently debate this with you because, as I said, I lost control of my morning and I did not have an opportunity to do my homework on this. I don't know to what extent people pay into flood insurance. I don't know what to,
sure.
I can't speak to it because I don't know. And that is my fault. I think it's been a long, long time since I went into a debate this stupid, and my apologies, but I don't have the information. Robert in Jonesville, Louisiana. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, you got to turn down the radio there or the TV or whatever it is. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Robert, you are on the air.
Yes, sir.
You are on the air right this minute. Robert?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. So, Robert, I'm going to put you back on hold. I'm sorry. I can hear you in the background there. Janice in Augusta, Georgia. Hey, Janice. You had some comments on disaster relief.
How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
That the lack of compassion from people in this country. This country was built on helping your neighbor.
Yeah.
The insurance companies, because it cut into their profits, have begun to refuse to insure people for certain things. And I don't think it's fair for someone who has millions of dollars to build in a place where their house may be destroyed and we pay for it. But yeah. There are everyday people who probably cannot afford to move from where they are, who need our help. And we ought to help them. I don't understand how that woman feels like it's those people's fault and that it is not our responsibility to look out for each other.
She was not trying to personalize it, to the best of my knowledge, to these individuals, although certainly that's the consequence of that kind of language and rhetoric. I think what she was saying, she was trying to make a free market argument. And, you know, as is typically the case, so-called free market arguments eventually fall apart. But the argument that she was making was that if there is no, you know, if an insurance company is unwilling to insure an area, then that, you know, that should cause the property values to either go way up or way down. I would guess they would go way down because the area would be so dangerous to build on because it would be uninsurable. And that by offering federal flood insurance, what we're doing is we're causing the property values to go back up again because, hey, it's insured. And that's messing in the marketplace. And there's a certain amount of logic to that. What I just don't know, again, my apologies, is to what extent we are insuring these things. And in fact, I'm going to be digging through the, see a bunch of people, Sue in the chat room has a bunch of links for me here. So my job, my work has been laid out for the break that's coming up in just a few seconds. So,
but the main problem with that is insurance companies are not in the business of paying out claims.
Yeah, no, they're in the business trying to avoid paying out claims.
Everything they can to not pay the claim.
Of course.
They're in business to make money.
Yep. Yep.
That's the bottom line.
And we, the people, are in business to provide for the general welfare and the common defense. And whether that's defense against British soldiers or whether it's defense against a hurricane, I think that we're part of the general defense. Janice, thank you for the call. I see David has some information on flood insurance. We'll pick him up as a caller right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And again, my apologies for sounding like one of those stupid NPR interviews where they get the right-wingers on and spout their talking points and they don't have a rebuttal. We will get more information right back. Okay, here's what I have learned about the National Flood Insurance Program. And by the way, the website is FEMA.gov/floodsmart. pages/faqs.jsp. And Sue will have that in our newsletter tonight when you get that. And it'll be in our daily stack on our website. The FEMA administers this insurance program. You can buy it for building property up to $250,000, contents up to $100,000. It actually is done in conjunction with 90 private insurance companies. It is only available to people who live in areas where they cannot buy flood insurance because private insurance companies have chosen not to sell flood insurance in that area. It's fairly limited in its scope. If you don't have flood insurance and you're wiped out, you get a FEMA grant, you are not only required to buy health insurance or flood insurance from that point forward, but you must do so all the time that you own that house. And when you transfer the house, all future buyers have to buy the federal health insurance or federal flood insurance. So this would not, I don't think, so much distort the marketplace. It would be reflected in the marketplace. And we're not talking about rebuilding mansions. This goes up to $250,000 and that's it. So, and they're, you know, why do I need flood insurance even though my community has never been flooded? They say flooding occurs in moderate to low risk areas as well as high risk areas. And by the way, flooding insurance is usually not covered in standard homeowners policies. And so you have to get this. So, on the other hand, it says, structures located in high-risk flood areas have a significant chance, more than 26% of suffering flood damage during the term of a 30-year mortgage. In a high-risk area, your home is more than twice as likely to be damaged by a flood than by fire. For these reasons, flood insurance is required by law for buildings in high-risk flood areas as a condition of receiving a mortgage from a federally regulated or insured lender. So, it sure looks to me like what the Republicans don't want to do is pay insurance claims. You know, if the federal government is the insurer of last resort in these areas, doesn't my homeowner insurance cover flooding? No, flood damage is not typically covered by homeowners insurance policies. If my home is flooded, won't federal disaster assistance pay for the damages? Not necessarily. Federal disaster assistance typically comes in the form of a low-interest loan to help cover flood damage, not compensation for your losses. And even then, those loans are not available if the president formally declares a disaster and must be repaid along with any existing mortgage. I mean, and it goes on and on. But basically, you know, the people in these areas, if they didn't have flood insurance and they get some kind of a grant, they're going to have to pay flood insurance. It is going to affect the property value of their house, not to mention the fact that these poor people got wiped out. And if they do have flood insurance, they have it through the federal government, in many cases in collaboration with one of these private insurance companies, and in some cases just straight through. So it is not this black and white thing that my last guest characterized of, oh, we're giving money to people who live in flood zones to rebuild their houses. Aren't we sweet? We shouldn't do that. That's stupid. That's not what's going on. David in M. Kenny, Iowa. Do I have that right?
Ankeny, Iowa, correct.
Great. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? You wanted to talk about flood insurance?
I live in the middle of Iowa, and we have a lot of floods. And flood insurance can range from region to region with federal flood insurance. I've checked several times with my homeowner's policy, and according to him, he doesn't even want me to get it because he says sometimes you fare better with FEMA than the national flood insurance. Also, floodplain areas in this area do not get to be covered. If you're in a floodplain, you're not covered. If you're just outside the floodplain, you can be covered. And it pays, at the time I checked last, 60% of the value of the structure. Hmm. And it didn't cover much of content inside it. So what you're reading probably is really partially true in different regions. And your insurance, your homeowner's insurance covers in this area because we all have sub pumps in our basements.
Mm-hmm.
And the sub pumps take care of the groundwater that comes up through the floor when we have heavy rains, and then it pumps it away so it doesn't flood your basement.
Right.
If your sub pump fails, your normal homeowner's insurance will not cover that flooding But if you take out extra rider on your insurance in case your sub pump fails, then it will cover that kind of flooding.
Right.
If your sewer backs up because of flooding, it floods the streets so heavy that the water pushes back into your house, your insurance does not. Yes, I think your insurance does cover sewer backup that way, but there's certain things it does. It covers your sewer backup if the flood comes in that way through your sewer, and it doesn't cover if your sub pump breaks down,
right.
And that's fresh water.
Right. Yeah.
Then
we're
down from the river. Okay. I'm sorry.
I got it. We're getting into so much detail here in the weeds, but the big picture, I think that you explained, it only covers a percentage of your losses. It's available in some places, not available in others. It's sometimes available through FEMA and sometimes available through your private insurance company. I got it. Thank you very much for the call. Excellent one. Claude in Oceanside, New York. Oceanside.
Hey,
gee, with a name like that, according to our last guest, you should not be eligible for insurance.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. I just went through Sandy. We ended up with 4 feet of water in our basement.
Yes.
And luckily we did have a cape with a basement. And my next-door neighbors who don't have basements or on slabs, they got wiped out on their first floor, their living space. And
right.
The difference is I was discriminated against because all of my possessions in the basement are not covered,
right.
Well, all of their possessions on the first floor are covered. So the question comes down to is why is it discriminatory for me when I own flood insurance, because my expectation of benefits is just as much as theirs, but yet I have a basement. They knew I had a basement before I entered the flood insurance program, so why did I have to pay the same premium, and now I have less benefit?
Now, you got your insurance through FEMA?
Correct. Well, it's through Allstate. It's the National Flood Insurance, because 9 square feet of my property is in the flood zone.
Right. So it's through Allstate, but is it backstopped by FEMA, or is this just you and Allstate?
No, it's me and FEMA. It's a FEMA flood insurance program through Allstate.
I see. Yeah. Okay. So this is so the insurance companies are basically acting as front men for FEMA, selling this federally funded flood insurance, presumably because Swiss Re and the other reinsurance companies wouldn't back up the insurance companies on this without that. What are your thoughts, Claude? How would you respond to somebody who says, okay, now that you know where you live is subject to flooding, time to move to Wyoming?
Well, a few things. I do hear that come next year they're going to mandate you don't get FEMA unless you did have flood insurance to begin with. So that's one thing I think
right.
is beneficial, because people next door to me, they got FEMA money because they didn't have flood insurance. And he said to me right out, he says, look, I've calculated what the risk was to me to pay the $600 a month. And you know what? It doesn't work out. It didn't work out for him.
Yeah.
So I understand his, you know, his numerics, but I just don't see it, because what I was worried about and what flood and what FEMA now has been told to me, it's really just for the structure. Like now my bricks on my stoop are now loose from the water, but you know what? They don't cover that. They only cover my four walls. So the point is that, is it really worthwhile? And another point you brought up in this last little description you gave, you said that if I accept the loan, so I assume that the loan is also the same thing as your SBA grant that you're talking about.
Right.
Because I did apply for the SBA loan. And the question comes down to is, so I do have flood insurance. I intend to keep my flood insurance. But you said if I transfer the house, the next owner is obligated to buy flood insurance because I got a grant on the house?
That's,
how could I obligate somebody?
That's what it says on the FEMA website.
That's news to me. Maybe if I mitigated and tried to do some mitigation process, like raising the house, if I wanted to, they request that people who do have low-lying first-floor houses at water
here's,
level.
Here's exactly what it says.
This is
on the floodsmart.gov website. It says, I live in a high-risk area. After my home was damaged in a flood, I received federal disaster assistance. Do I need to purchase flood insurance now? Answer, yes. If you live in an SFHA and have, that's a high flood risk area,
mm-hmm.
and have received disaster assistance in the form of a federal grant or a loan, you must cover the building for flood insurance for as long as you own it. Should you sell the building, you are required by law to inform the new owner of the necessity to purchase and maintain flood insurance. Failure to carry flood insurance could result in the denial of future federal disaster assistance.
Okay, so that's all his obligation is to get federal disaster assistance.
Right. Right. So, in other words, basically,
if
you can be totally naked in the future, but they're not going to rebuild your house again, or
right.
you can buy into the insurance program, and probably the premiums are set at a rate where, you know, if this happens every 20 years, we're not losing money on it. So, interesting point. You said 1 minute, Shano? Okay. Thank you for the call. Robert in Jonesville, Louisiana. That 1 minute is yours. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Listen, I was... You there?
Yeah, you're on the air.
I was calling about the FEMA insurance. I'm a contractor, and I work all over the United States. And I worked the four hurricanes in Florida and Katrina and all the other hurricanes. But anyway, what I was going to tell you is FEMA is nothing but a deal to work. Now, I'm talking about not flooding. I'm talking about if people need assistance from FEMA from a hurricane and their house didn't get flooded.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about as far as getting assistance for a homeowner, there's no way. What they do it for the town or like New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
They do it for the buildings and the city, but they don't actually help the homeowners.
Right, unless you have this individual flood insurance, which you can get through floodsmart.gov. Very interesting. Thank you, Robert, for that. And so basically, what they're rebuilding is the commons. I wanted to mention what London and Amsterdam have done.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In London, outside the Thames River, they've built these giant flood walls, and large chunks of Holland are actually below sea level. They've got dikes. Let's check into the news for the day, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of that slave and your goat, often taken by Ellen Ratner when she gets over to Sudan, South Sudan, 3-4 times a year. And the Talk Radio News Service, of course, bringing us the news, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, nice to see your smiling face.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
President Obama had a press conference this morning, a very short notice, which is always interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Never quite sure why that's going to happen. And he made it very clear where he stands on raising the debt ceiling. He said that if congressional Republicans refuse to pay America's bills on time, and then he laid out a very stark vision of what will happen, including not being able to pay our troops, Social Security checks being delayed, veterans' benefits being delayed, food inspectors, air traffic controllers, specialists tracking down loose nukes, investors, markets going haywire, interest rates spiking. I think we get the picture here.
Yeah.
And then he also said, and he really laid it, I think he summarized it here very well. And I just want to repeat, because I think sometimes the American people understandably aren't following all the debates here in Washington. Raising the debt ceiling does not authorize us to spend more. All it does is say that America will pay its bills, and we are not a deadbeat nation. And the consequences of us not paying our bills, as I outlined in my opening statement, would be disastrous.
Now, do a reality check for me here on this.
Yeah.
During President Obama's first term, my recollection is that he very rarely used the word Republican in a pejorative sense, you know, as in the Republicans in Congress are trying to screw this thing up. Instead, he would say politics is screwing this thing up, or there are some people, or, you know, some folks in Congress don't take this, you know, that kind of thing. And today I heard him use the word Republican several times, and to me, that seemed like it was something relatively new. Am I accurate in that perception, or have I just not been? I mean, you're in the White House virtually every day. You sit through these press briefings. You know these people. You've hung out with the president and Jay Carney and whatnot. Am I right in that observation, or am I missing something?
No, you're not missing something. At the beginning, he didn't, and then he started to pick and choose. And it would depend, really, where negotiations were. And sometimes I'll listen, like in a negotiation on the fiscal cliff, and he might say, Congress has to do its job. And then you think to yourself, oh, it's going quite well, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then if he says, Republicans in Congress, then you think, oh, God, it's all gone pear-shaped.
So it's when he calls out the Republicans, that means that he's worried that he's not going to get what he thinks he should have?
Or he feels like he's either going to war, he's in a war, or it's time for him to be populist.
Hmm. How long has he been doing this throughout his 4 years,
no,
or is this recent?
I don't think so. I think this is more recent. I'd say this is the last 18 months or so. I'm not good on time,
okay,
but I would say certainly within the last year to 18 months, he's been more populist like this.
Well, I am very glad to hear it and see it. So,
He was. And he gave another analogy about how you don't go out to dinner and then eat all you want and leave without paying the check.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, now if Congress wants to have a debate about maybe we shouldn't go out to dinner next time, maybe we should go to a more modest restaurant, that's fine. Talking about discussing cutting spending after raising the debt ceiling, I thought one of the most interesting things that he said was when he talked about House Republicans again. What's motivating and propelling at this point some of the House Republicans?
Mm-hmm.
He said they have a particular vision about what government should and should not do, so they are suspicious about government's commitments to make sure that seniors have decent health care. They have suspicions about Social Security. And then he went on to talk about some other things they have suspicions about. And it was fascinating that he used this word, suspicions, to describe House Republicans. I've never heard him talk like that before.
Hmm. What do you think he meant?
I think he's talking about conservative Republicans wanting to get rid of these programs.
Yeah.
I think that's what he's talking about.
So is he inching his way toward Give 'em Hell Harry-ism?
He seemed to be going in that direction, because even when he was asked a friendly question about why he doesn't socialize, he said that at the congressional picnic, they come up to him and they're all very friendly, but it doesn't stop that. And he was friendly too, but it doesn't stop them going on the House floor and denouncing him as a socialist.
Really? He said that?
Yes.
Well, I missed the very last part of his press conference. It might have been.
Yes. As a something spending socialist, it was actually. Rather spending socialist, yes.
Yeah.
He also said today that Vice President Biden's task force on guns has presented him with a list of sensible common sense steps that can be taken, and he expects to have a fuller presentation later in the week. So that presentation has been made, and he's now reviewing Biden's recommendations.
Cool. And when do we expect to hear this publicly?
Sometime later this week. I mean, it's going to be quick.
Do you think they're going to try and get the legislation passed right after the inauguration when Congress is
going? I think they're going to move quickly. He also said he's not concerned about whether his proposals will pass.
Hmm.
He said, my starting point is not to worry about the politics, saying he's focused on what makes sense, what works to reduce gun violence. If there's a step we can take that will save even one child from what happened in Newtown, we should take that step. When he said, will all of them get through this Congress? I don't know, saying he's determined to try. So it sounds to me like he's prepared to go bold here. Some people thought he might not. Sounds to me like he is.
Yeah, and by the way, that is all about politics. Because if he goes bold and he gets shot down by the Republicans, the American people are going to hold the Republicans accountable.
Yes, and he knows that.
Indeed. Okay, yeah. So what else is going on?
The other thing is that the Sandy aid bill will come to the House floor tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
and Northeastern Republicans are livid by the nearly 100 amendments that have been filed, added to the bill. The Rules Committee will meet tonight to decide what stays. The whole thing could go wrong.
Wow. And these are amendments by Republicans, by and large?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Of course, trying to kill the bill. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goodsfortheoldgood.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I want to get into talking about Aaron Swartz and this whole disaster. This young 26-year-old young man committing suicide because the federal government had decided to make an example of him, and the general insanity of some of our copyright laws and some of our anti-hacking laws. But first, I know I've got at least a couple of callers who might be able to bring something to the conversation we've been having about flood insurance, and I'd like to get through that, and then I'll come back to Aaron Schwartz in just a moment. In Fort Lauderdale, Brad. Hey, Brad. You are an insurance adjuster?
Yes, Tom. How are you doing today?
Great. Are you an insurance adjuster?
I'm an insurance adjuster in Florida. I've been one for about 8 years now, and I've worked both sides of the industry as a public adjuster, which we have in Florida that represents policyholders, you know, homeowners and such, and also for the insurance companies, and I've been NFIP certified to do flood claims.
So how does it work, and how do you respond to people who say that the only reason that Florida real estate has any value at all is because the feds and the state are basically subsidizing the risk factor of hurricanes and floods?
Well, one of the things I think you have to be careful with is the word subsidy, meaning that the government is paying a portion of it. I mean, these policies are rated and they have premiums, and we pay for these. And, of course, the tax dollars go into it as well. For the NFIP, the premiums are pretty low, but that's because they spread the risk across the entire country, which is part of the problem with insurance in general, be it health or homeowners or otherwise, that we limit the risk pool, so the premiums are high. That's our problem in Florida with hurricane insurance. But for the NFIP, I mean,
that's the National Flood Insurance Program, the NFIP.
Right. The NFIP. And by the way, all flood insurance policies are NFIP. Private insurers don't write the policies. Much the way banks do with loans sometimes, they service the policies for the policyholders, but they don't write the policies. It all comes out of the federal kitty, so to speak.
So it's basically a Fannie Mae loan or a Freddie Mac loan. It's not a Chelsea Bank loan or whatever.
Exactly right. And you know, the problem with the flood insurance as well is because it's one of these kind of government pools of money, it's all run through FEMA, and FEMA has a limited budget. So depending on how they've allocated that budget, the NFIP may or may not have money to pay the claims. And that's the problem up in the Northeast right now is the budget is empty. There's no money to pay the claims, and they need this money to go through Congress to pay the claims. One quick thing, I know that you're to bring a political note into this and something you probably appreciate. I don't know if you remember during Hurricane Katrina, Trent Lott, the former Senate Majority Leader, had a house right there in the Gulf of Mississippi.
Right.
That was destroyed by Katrina, $750,000. Now, incidentally, he did have an NFIP policy, which only covers $200,000, but was on the floor of the Senate and had George Bush down there railing about getting money to help these people because, of course, him and all his friends in his rich neighborhood lost their homes. Yet we don't have any politicians up in the Northeast who appear to have lost their homes because of this, and now the money's just getting stuck in Congress. Nobody wants to push it through.
Well, it's the Republicans that are stuck in Congress. It's not the Democrats. The Democrats are perfectly willing to jump in on this thing, as is the administration. But there's this the libertarian bunch of the Republicans in Congress who I think reflect the same point of view as Nicole, as my guest, which is that the free market is the beginning and end of everything, and it should be defining everything, and anything that the government gets involved with distorts the free market, and therefore government should play no role in this. And I think
a point that's kind of lost on them with that argument too is the free market dictates that we have to have this insurance. At least in Florida, I can speak. If you own a mortgage and you live in the flood zone, which is dictated by the NFIP, you're required to carry flood insurance. You have a choice. And the only person you can buy it from is from the NFIP. That's it. So it's the free market dictating that we have to have this.
So it's not, but that's not the free market dictating it. That's the government dictating it, is it not?
No, it's the mortgage companies. It's the banks who hold your mortgage. Part of your mortgage. Just like you have to have homeowners insurance, they require you to carry flood insurance.
Right. So they're just covering their butts.
Exactly. And, of course, most of these financial institutions that are the banks who do mortgages, a lot of them are also insurance companies or have subsidiaries for insurance companies. So it's all part of the same, entity, if you will. They require this insurance, but none of the insurance companies will write the policies, so they leave it for the government to take care of. And then force us to buy them.
Right. Now, what is the fund that ran out that has to be replenished with this legislation from Congress? I mean, if you've got a national flood insurance program, covers the entire nation, people all across the nation are paying into it, whether they live along a little stream in Oklahoma or they live on the West Coast or they live in Sandy Hook, it doesn't matter. Or not Sandy Hook, the ocean side.
Sure.
Shouldn't that be a federal pool of money, or are they regional? Do they operate as regional pools of money or state pools of money? How does that work?
No, it's all FEMA. My understanding is this is all through FEMA, and it's all part of FEMA's budget. The money all goes into the federal coffers and FEMA's budget, certain amounts of money. The thing with the flood insurance program, anybody can buy into it, but only people who are in designated flood zones are required to have it.
Right, but so my question is, why are they out of money? Why do they need Congress to appropriate money for them?
The same reason my Social Security doesn't have any money, because it was in there in a bank account somewhere, and they came in and took it and used it for other things and left a bunch of IOUs. There's just no money in the budget.
Could it be that FEMA didn't so much use it for other things as that we've had global weirding? I mean, Joplin, Missouri got wiped out, and that cost FEMA a fortune. Hundreds and hundreds of tornadoes in the last year that took out big chunks of the Midwest. FEMA had to go into all of those places. You had Hurricane Katrina a couple of years ago. FEMA was down there. I mean, could it just be that FEMA is just tapped out?
Well, absolutely. But again, my understanding is that this is a yearly budget thing. All the money goes into FEMA, and they allocate a certain portion of their budget to pay FEMA claims. And when the money runs out yearly, the money runs out yearly. And when you have all these disasters kind of compounding each other, and they don't increase that budget amount or allocate any additional money for that, the money's just not there.
Right. But people in good faith paid into this federal flood insurance program, and now the Republicans in Congress are saying, no, we're not going to pay off on your policy, basically.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. But part of the problem, of course, also is the premiums are ridiculously low. It's one of the things, and I live in Florida, and I pay it as well, and I hate to see my bills go up, but, I mean, to insure the max amount in Florida, and I live in an area that's a flood zone, my premium bill is $300 and change a month. And that covers, $250,000 for my building. And
that's a lot of money.
$300 a year, excuse me.
Oh, $300 a year, okay.
Not a $300 a year.
Yeah.
So the premiums are pretty low, and my understanding is that's a
now, could that be because they cap out these policies at $250,000?
Well, yeah, absolutely, and that's another thing as well. These are very limited policies. This isn't like your homeowner's policy, and I know you had one caller previously who talked about how the stuff in his basement wasn't covered. That's absolutely right. These policies cover limited stuff. It's not like your homeowner's policy where you have a covered loss, and after deductible, they pay you to replace it.
These are kind of the flood equivalent of Walmart's health insurance policy, If you're really, really sick and you have really, really big bills, it might help out a little bit, but otherwise, if you spend just a couple $1,000 a year and go see the doctor when your kid breaks his arm, you're still out of pocket. And
the difference is you have a choice to buy that. Well, to some degree, you have a choice whether to buy that Walmart health insurance policy, but you have no choice. The NFIP is the only game in town.
Brad, thank you for the call, and thanks for all the information. It's much appreciated. Alan in Carterville, Illinois. A minute to the break, Alan. It's yours.
Yeah, just a tidbit of information to you, Tom. If you want to purchase homeowners insurance, you're basically bound to buy the flood insurance. There's no choice for you whether you buy the flood insurance or not. I don't know
in
if
Florida.
That's clear or not.
You have a home in Florida, and you're basing this on that experience?
Yes, that's what I'm basing that experience on. A good friend of mine, a co-worker, owned his home outright, so he was able to make the choice. Because he's in a brick stucco home with a roof, and when he added up the premiums, what they wanted for homeowners insurance, plus that, he goes for the flood. What am I going to be doing? Cleaning out the sand and retiling the floors?
Yeah. Well, according to the FEMA website, if I read it correctly, if you live in a home that has greater than a 26% chance of a flood hitting it during the lifetime of the home, which could be 100 years, then you have to buy the insurance. If it's less than a 26% risk, then it's optional. But good point, Alan. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So slowly we're figuring this stuff out. We're learning all about it. I want to talk about Aaron Schwartz, too, when we get back. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Some thoughts here on Aaron Schwartz. I wanted to share this with you. First of all, here's a clip from our program of Aaron Schwartz. You get a sense of who this guy is.
Your listeners may remember SOPA and PIPA were these bills that would allow the government to censor websites on the internet. And they were pushed by the entertainment industry, especially by Hollywood, in order to allow them to shut down sites that had copyrighted music and movies and, who knows what else they wanted to shut down. And so that was soundly defeated thanks to an enormous outcry of people all over the internet and progressive activists And now we're seeing a similar kind of bill, but not from Hollywood, but this time it's from the Pentagon. And instead of just letting the government censor the Internet, the idea behind the bill is to allow the government to spy on the Internet as well. So basically, the military will be given control over key portions of the Internet and will be allowed to access all sorts of personal, private information without going through the normal privacy safeguards.
And, you know, they didn't like him talking like that. When the profiteers in Hollywood and corporate America tried to wall up and censor the Internet last year with SOPA and PIPA, activists needed a spark to fight back against the assault on the free and open web, and Aaron Schwartz was there. The Internet trailblazer and activist who had already contributed such things to the web as an early version of the RSS feed and Reddit stood up and joined the vanguard in this movement. He co-founded the organization Demand Progress, which was instrumental in leading the largest online protest in the history of the Internet against SOPA and PIPA. Thanks to this effort, on January 18, 2012, tens of thousands of websites blacked out, and ultimately SOPA and PIPA were defeated by this online grassroots activism. Today, that same Internet is blacked out with remembrances and obituaries of Aaron Schwartz, who took his life over the weekend. And in each of those remembrances, Aaron is described as a spark that made things happen. And for the rest of us who still believe, as Aaron did, in a free and open Internet and a compassionate and just nation, a message he often espoused on our show, we can only hope he provides the same sort of spark in death that he did in life. He was never afraid to talk about the depression he battled most of his life, often giving eloquent and deeply personal insight into how difficult it is to fight that disease. Ultimately, Aaron lost his battle with depression, just like so many other Americans who never received the help they need in a nation that doesn't consider health care, especially mental health care, a basic human right. But the depression alone didn't kill Aaron. In a statement released over the weekend, Aaron's family placed the blame on our Department of Justice, which was prosecuting Aaron for an incident that happened back on the campus of MIT back in 2011. Aaron snuck into a utility closet on MIT's campus, plugged a computer into the network, and began downloading millions of academic journals that were stored behind a paywall belonging to the online database JSTOR. Alan likely knew that this was illegal, although the expert witness for Aaron's defense, Alex Stamos, argues that Aaron's actions may not have been criminal after all. Regardless, Aaron was an activist who was willing to challenge the status quo of corporate welfare copyright laws that restrict the free flow of information from academic journals to music to movies on the Internet, and he was willing to blur the lines of legality in that effort. In fact, Aaron was acting in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, who himself was not too keen on the idea of heavy-handed patents on ideas and intellectual properties. As Jefferson wrote in 1813, quote, that ideas should spread freely from one to another over the globe for the moral and mutual instruction of man and improvement of his condition seems to have been peculiarly and benevolently designed by nature when she made them, like fire, expansible over all space without lessening their density at any point, and like the air in which we breathe, move, and have our physical being, incapable of confinement or exclusive appropriation. End quote. Jefferson then concluded, inventions then cannot, in nature, be a subject of property. Society may give an exclusive right to the profits arising from them as an encouragement to men to pursue ideas which may produce utility, but this may or may not be done according to the will and convenience of the society without claim or complaint from anybody. End of quote. Given the activism we've seen on the Internet over the last few years, one could conclude that just as Jefferson described, patent and copyright laws should be changed according to the will and convenience of the society. To quote Jefferson, this was one of Aaron's pursuits. That's not to justify Aaron's crime, but instead to put it in some much-needed context. There are gray-haired lawmakers in corporate suits writing laws that no longer make sense given how the vast majority of this new generation actually uses the Internet. And arguably, we're nearing a tipping point in which this disconnect will be untenable. This might explain why the Department of Justice reacted to Aaron's MIT antics in the way that it did. Rather than cede ground in this upcoming struggle, the powers that be decided to squash the struggle from the get-go by making an example out of Aaron. Despite it being a victimless crime and JSTOR itself settling the matter with Aaron, the Department of Justice threw the book at him. He was charged with multiple crimes and faced the possibility of serving decades in prison. a harsher punishment than most killers, bank robbers, child pornographers, and terrorist sympathizers get. Secret Service even involved itself in the matter. And at the urging of the U.S. Attorney for the Massachusetts District, Carmen Ortiz, Aaron was looking at the very real possibility of spending much of the rest of his life in prison. As Aaron's family said in a statement, his death was the result of, quote, an exceptionally harsh array of charges carrying potentially over 30 years in prison to punish an alleged crime that had no victims, end quote. Aaron was an activist, not a murderer. The punishment for his crime should have reflected that reality, but it didn't. Instead, Aaron was dogged to death by an overzealous Justice Department that targets activists and whistleblowers with all its fury while turning a blind eye to actual criminals, thieves, and murderers on Wall Street and in corporate America. This is the same sort of prosecutorial overreach we're now getting used to in a nation that more and more resembles a police state. It's a nation where soldiers like Bradley Manning, whistleblowers like John Curacao, politicians like former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, who dared to take on Karl Rove, and medical marijuana growers receive the full brunt of the American justice system and suffer dearly for their crimes or non-crimes. But at the same time, banksters who steal billions and corporate executives who are responsible for the death of their employees on oil rigs and in mine shafts, they never see a day in jail. This is a screwed up system. We need to do something about it. Hopefully, Aaron Swartz's life and death will be an awakening moment for all of us. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Flood insurance, the Second Amendment as a tool to enforce slavery. Aaron Swartz, should we have even copyright and patent laws in the United States? The very, very cherubimimically ugly, brought to you by Edison Factor, food for your brain, edisonfactor.com. The good, San Diego Mayor Bob Filner. Filner has sent memos to zoning and code enforcement officers in San Diego, ordering them to end all code enforcement actions against medical marijuana facilities in that city. Filner is also encouraging the city council to take up the issue of formal zoning rules for medical marijuana distribution. And he has directed the city's police chief to end all medical marijuana enforcement actions. Elected in November, Filner ran largely on a platform of decriminalizing marijuana and protecting the use of medical marijuana. Looks like Mayor Filner is one politician who understands just how outdated and ineffective this nation's drug laws are. Let's hope he's just the first of many. The bad. Rince Priebus. Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, told the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal Sentinel that Republicans across the country need to do more gerrymandering to gain electoral votes in states that are Republican controlled, but usually vote Democratic in national elections. Priebus said, I think it's something that a lot of states that have been consistently blue that are fully controlled red ought to be looking at. So it looks like Republicans are content with expanding on their 2012 strategy. When all else fails, rig the election. And the very, very ugly Connie Mack. The former Republican congressman was on CNN this morning, live from Newtown, Connecticut. In the wake of the one-month anniversary of the Newtown tragedy, Mack told CNN's Soledad O'Brien that it's impossible to stop people who want to do bad things and that Congress is wasting its time talking about new gun control measures. Mack went on to say that passing new laws only serves to, quote, restrict law-abiding citizens of this country's rights. That bad people do bad things argument, right. It's popular on the right, but it certainly isn't a reason to give up making America's schools, streets, and communities safer. Mack is content with the notion that there will always be gun violence in America and that we shouldn't try to prevent it. And that is very, very ugly. Boy, is that ugly. Karen in Shelton, Connecticut. Hey, Karen, were you in the flood area?
Yes, I am. I'm actually in the process of, hold on, microphone. I'm sorry about that. We are in the process of mitigating the flood with a grant from FEMA,
mm-hmm.
and that elevating our house. We're in the final stages of it, and we're very grateful for the help. And we live on a river that has flooded repeatedly. In 2011, we had 3 50-year storms.
Wow.
So our house had water in it. When I say in it, it's in the kitchen, the living room, the bedroom, the bathroom, throughout the whole thing. It's just a little house.
Right.
So FEMA has grants available, but they go through the state and the locals, and it's very involved. It's not easy to do. It's worth doing. The grant we're in is a hazard mitigation grant.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what are you doing, jacking your house up and putting it on stilts like they do down in the Keys?
Yeah, exactly. It's on stilts, although we're able to enclose the bottom portion and make a garage space.
Uh-huh.
So that's very nice. But
yeah, I've seen that in houses from South Carolina all the way down to the Florida Keys. A friend of mine lives in a house like that in Key West.
Yeah, and anything that you have on the ground level, you can't claim for.
Right.
If you've elevated your house. So right. That's off the table right off the bat. We had to elevate it 2 feet above the 100-year floodplain, so we're way up there.
Mm-hmm.
And our flood insurance, the good part, is it's going to drop, our premium's going to drop from about $1,700-$1,800 a year down to probably about $300 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to help as well. And we're never, ever going to have to worry about flooding again. And it is a cost savings. And the grant that we're in, the homeowner supplies 25% and FEMA pays 75%.
Now, is that free money to you, or is that the consequence of your having paid into an insurance program for years and years, that 75%?
That's the consequence of having paid high premiums for flood insurance all these years.
I see. So
And that we've flooded repeatedly is
right.
The problem.
Do you have neighbors who never paid for flood insurance who are also getting grants, or are those grants not available to people who've never paid into the insurance program?
No, they're not available unless you've been paying into the grant program, unless you've got flood insurance.
So it's sort of like your money coming back to you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Or at least, you know.
Either that or the home is worthless.
Right, right. Are there people whose homes have been rendered worthless and the city has reclaimed the land and compensated them?
Well, there was just a story locally, a few towns up north of here in Plainville, Connecticut, where 14 homes are being purchased and they will be demolished and the land will be just land. Nothing will be built on there.
Yeah. Turn into a park or something or
right.
let somebody
but
grow pumpkins on it.
There are different kinds of grants is the point. And
mm-hmm.
Like I say, it's not easy to get on board, but, you know, flooding isn't easy.
Sure, sure. It's a fairly well-populated country, and land values are absurdly high in a lot of places. And for some people, hey, this is where I grew up. It's where I want to stay.
In our situation, I mean, it's not only that, you know, people are stupid and you buy houses where, you know, it's going to flood. In our case, we're situated between two dams on a river. And so it's Mother Nature, yes, but it's also the dams have some control over it. Although when you speak to the dams, they assume no control. And they're federally licensed by Federal Energy Regulatory Commission because they're hydroelectric dams. And I could spend an hour just trying to get into the weeds with you. But
yeah.
I did want to make the point that these things... that flood insurance is something that people who live in floodplains, we carry.
Pay for.
As a matter of fact, you can't get a mortgage without it.
Right. Now, I'm curious, to what extent is the actions of the Republicans in Congress who figure, hey, if you live in a flood zone, tough luck, Charlie, you should have been born a millionaire. To what extent is the action by those Republicans going to affect you if they say no?
I don't know if it's not affecting me right now because we're waiting for reimbursement. We've submitted tens of thousands of dollars, and we're waiting for about $40,000 reimbursement. We're right now at a standstill. We can't finish the project without getting that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that's because of what's being done in Congress.
Right. It may well be because it looks like FEMA's out of money. And,
yeah.
And one of the reasons why, you know, Chris Christie's out there banging his fist. Okay, Karen, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Jim in Andersonville, Tennessee. Hey, Jim, you lived in Florida?
Hi, Tom. First, I have to say, watching your show is a lot of work. It really makes me think.
Well, that's a good thing, I guess.
Yes, it is. The reason that I called is regarding to your guest. I lived in South Florida, and when I lived down there, we used to get a substantial amount of money tacked on to our homeowner's insurance to pay for a state-run insurance fund that allowed people to build mansions, essentially, in environmentally sensitive areas. And, of course, those areas were basically, you know,
seacoast.
Ground zero for hurricanes.
Yeah. So now, a question. The FEMA program only insures up to $250,000. Mm-hmm. So you got all these people running around going, "Oh, I'm not gonna pay for, you know, John Corzine to rebuild his mansion on the seacoast," or, you know, whatever. I don't know if he has one or not, but sure. Just pulling famous New Jerseyan out of the hat. But FEMA would only pay $250,000, and you can't build. I mean, I've never seen a mansion on the seacoast that was selling for $250,000. I mean, usually just the lots themselves are selling for $1 million or so. So
yeah, I agree with that.
Do you know if the state had a similar limit?
I'm sorry?
Do you know if the state had a similar limit so that you weren't actually subsidizing the mansions?
I'm not sure. I think they did have a limit, but I'm not sure what it was. But essentially what they were doing was allowing people to build in the evacuation areas.
Mm.
And because the private insurance company didn't want to have anything to do with that, they would go to the insurer of last resort, which was the state of Florida.
Right.
And then there was even a show on 60 Minutes about the Carolinas where there, I think it was the federal government is doing the same thing, where these people are building homes on the shoreline, expecting them to get knocked down every 20 years, and the government would come in and pay their insurance bills. And to me, that kind of goes to the point that your guest was trying to make.
Yeah.
It really doesn't make sense that, I mean, what they did to us in Florida wasn't technically a tax, but it might as well have been because we had to pay it in order to get insurance.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with that notion. I mean, there's a certain point at which you have to say, you know, caveat emptor, buyer beware. This property is uninsurable by anybody, and really there shouldn't be a house on it. And the next time that house gets washed away, if the state has any sense of responsibility whatsoever, it should say, you know, we're going to acquire this property under eminent domain, reimburse the homeowner, and let them find someplace else to live. Although I suspect my guest would have said the state shouldn't even do that. They should just say, hey, you shouldn't have been, you know, dumb enough to buy in that
in the first place.
You know, right. And as I said, I don't think that's always a choice that people make. And you're assuming people have informed consent and they've done a little bit of research, which is very often not the case. So, Jim, thank you for the call. Thanks for the... We're learning a lot. It's really cool having a radio show with the smartest people on earth listening and watching. We'll be back. I really do. It fills in a lot of gaps for me, and hopefully for you too. Hopefully this is a valuable conversation, because this is something that is going to be made into a big deal in Congress over the next week or so. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Should FEMA just do away with flood insurance altogether? Should we just tell these people, hey, you know, like Ron Paul, die in the curb, die in the ditch, die in the ocean? 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Pat in Macomb, Michigan. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call. This doesn't have anything to do with what you're talking about today, but I want to get your take on this. We have an island here in the Detroit River called Belle Isle. It's between Detroit and Canada.
I'm familiar with it. I'm familiar with it, yeah.
Okay. Well, a group of investors, private investors, one being the Mackinac Center, is going to pitch an idea to the Chamber of Commerce next week. They want to buy it for $1 billion. They want to turn it into a private commonwealth with 35,000 residents buying in at $300,000 apiece with their own laws, customs, and currency. My question to you is that could this turn into a tax haven like the Cayman Islands? Isn't this a form of succession? And what can we do about this?
My response to your first two questions is a rhetorical question. Is a frog's butt watertight? Apparently.
Oops, I'm sorry.
Apparently,
are you there?
I shocked you. Pat, yes. In answer to your first two questions, yes. whether it's legal or not, I don't know. I don't know. You know, the government can dispose of property that it owns. It sounds like if the Mackinac Center is involved, which is a libertarian-leaning think tank up, you know, there in Michigan and heavily funded, I believe, by the DeVos family or DeVos family, it may well be that what they're trying to do is create the very first libertarian paradise on Earth. You know, it's they're trying to do in Atlas Shrugged what John Galt did, you know, go off and, you know, just the makers, not the takers. And I wonder where they're going to get their help from. You know, who's going to build, you know, who's going to maintain their houses if they don't allow janitors on the island?
Of the people that would be allowed to live there would not have to buy in for the $300,000. There's an article in the Detroit News about it.
Very, very interesting. I'll have to check that out. In terms of becoming a tax haven, yeah, of course. I mean, if they have that worldview, then they're going to try and make it a little Liechtenstein. See, keep in mind, this has happened in Europe, and Liechtenstein is one example. And Isle of Wight is another, where they're basically tax havens, and that's their primary revenue source. Closer to here, it's Bermuda and the Bahamas, where people, you know, shelter their income there and hide their income, and they make an enormous amount of money off it. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. That's fascinating. Pat, thank you for the information. I'm going to have to look that one up. David in Portland. Hey, David.
How are you doing, Tom? I was I've gotten to listen to your whole show today, and it's real interesting. I read about Aaron Schwartz on Friday, and I was very saddened by that. I read some articles about him since then, because I'm a big Reddit fan. And, you know, it's funny. I learned about Reddit about 4 months ago from a 23-year-old. I'm a little older. I'm 52 now. But I never would have found the site had it not been for somebody who was a lot younger. And I have to say that is a fantastic site. And I liken Aaron Schwartz to like Julian Assange, somebody who's just out to put the information out to people.
Yeah.
And actually what I wanted to talk about today was I had found a video through Reddit, actually, by a person by the name of Guy McPherson. Do you know who he is?
No, I don't.
Do you know? Okay. Well, he's a conservation biologist, Professor Emeritus from University of Arizona, and he's got a video on YouTube that's called The Twin Sides of the Fossil Fuel Coin. I highly recommend anybody go to that because it's kind of disturbing. You know, all this talk about the fiscal cliff sounds a lot like, after watching this video, I watched a number of other videos of his, but it sounds like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen the BBC special on the Permian extinction?
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about the subject of global warming, and it seems a lot more dire than, you know, when we talk about 2 degrees centigrade increase. That's going to lead to a rapid 6 degrees rise, which we're all gone.
Right. And while the Permian extinction was the most comprehensive extinction in the history of the planet. And 95% of all animal life and 95% of all plant life died. This is only 250 million years ago. What rose out of the Permian extinction were giant lizards, the dinosaurs, and they survived until 65 million years ago when a meteorite hit the Earth. And very small mammals who survived the meteor strike and became you and me, along with pretty much everything else that's a mammal. And so the question was, what caused the Permian extinction? And it turns out that it was a massive volcanic release in Siberia that warmed up the atmosphere about 5 degrees Celsius. That wasn't enough to kill off 95% of all life, though. What that did is that warmed up the oceans 5 degrees Celsius, and thus these methane hydrate crystal beds, you know, miles and miles and hundreds of billions of tons of methane, frozen methane down in the seabeds, the result of vegetation decomposing and falling down and producing this gas, they started to warm up and it bubbled up like soda pop. This is the soda pop theory out of the oceans.
That's exactly.
And when all that methane went into the atmosphere, because it's 25 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, it raised the planet another 5 degrees. And that cumulative 10 degrees was enough to kill 95% of all life on Earth.
Exactly. These are called like rapid, nonlinear, and unpredictable responses.
That's right. Positive feedback loops.
Positive feedbacks, and we're getting into that right now. We're already seeing these methane vents in Siberia going from a foot in diameter to a kilometer in diameter in a year's time. It seems like we're already on a
on a very slippery slope. But,
yes.
But he talks about, I got to just say this one thing. He talks about our only chance, really, of life survival on Earth is the a total crash of our industrial economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
Which would radically reduce our fossil fuel consumption.
It would kill off most people. But it's the only way we could stop it. If we go back to the heat room instead of
unless we can really quickly figure out some way to generate all of our electricity from solar. And David, thank you for the call. And also figure out a way to sequester the carbon that's up there already. We're past 380, past 390, in fact. We need to get back down to 350. Coming up tomorrow, more on the debt ceiling talks, the latest on VP Biden's ideas for gun control, the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. You have to show up and participate. So get out there, get active, go to pdamerica.org, move to amend.org, tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.